So one of the things I've been doing in recent years is looking at the socio-cultural aspect of this fringe philosophy that we're all involved in the cryptozoology community. Largely, it would seem that we are looking into stories and possibilities of as yet unclassified animals. But there's this crossover that keeps happening all the time. And the crossover is, it seems to be more and more related to folkloric entities, goblins, trolls, UFOs, orbs, and the rest of it. And that I was reminded of this recently in an article, which is not the only time I've written about this, but about areas of high strangeness in the UK and in America and other places. And I was asked about it. Why do you think in some of these areas, like England's Cannock Chase in Staffordshire, why do you think there's stories of werewolves and Bigfoot, trolls, people in black-eyed children, UFOs, orbs in locales like that? And also, why are there similar stories in places of high strangeness in the USA, reporting similar kinds of phenomena? And it seemed reasonable to me that these places that seem to have such a high density of weird entities, because of their sociological background origins. So they had more to do with cautionary tales that our ancestors taught to their children to keep them safe in the natural world that was then a very wild and hostile place, rather than any real fear or bona fide paranormal entities. And I thought, well, it's still coincidence that these areas normally exist in relatively small catchment areas on the borders of towns. And that itself, including the background culture that the people came from in both the UK and the USA, could reinforce the theory that these were mysteries or man-made, emanating primarily from ghost stories told around a campfire and ancient ecumenical proclamations from the pulpit. Now, many of these beings that have been described, especially in the populations of the former colonies of the USA and North America, Australia, New Zealand, for example, seem to be watered-down versions of their original European counterparts that were handed down so long ago, in such a natural way, the new nation has forgotten their origins. So, viewed in this light, becomes then easy to pick apart the tales of dogmen, werewolves, Bigfoot, wild men, pukwudgies, pugs and imps, orbs, will-o'-the-wisps, and UFOs, even as chariots of fire, and lake monsters, water horses, pierced, all the rest of it, by simply matching their witnesses or the witnesses of them with their background ethnicity. So, if you're living in the USA, and you've suddenly seen, an orb, or you're not seeing the same thing that your European counterpart or ancestor saw 300 or 400 years ago and described as a will-o'-the-wisp. Now, a very obvious example of this would be the proliferation of the Duende, the little people legends among both the peoples of Portugal and Spain, and the nations of Latin America. Oh, and places like the Philippines as well in the Far East, all of whom have this Latin background, this Spanish Portuguese background. Now, surely logic dictates the Duende legend is a colonial transplant into Latin America and not an example of an invasive species shipped across the Atlantic by the conquistadors. Chupacabra, I think, is probably another unknown beast that seems to be primarily encountered in Latin America and US states. The high density of Spanish-speaking citizens, and that might go some way to explaining why there wasn't much of a crossover into the northern states of the USA, where Spanish isn't a commonly spoken language. What can we conclude from this? I think it's clear that background culture However far removed has a deep psychological impact on our belief systems and even on how we interpret strange phenomena, but which we've got no experiential point of reference. What am I saying? I'm not saying that this theory claims that people are making stuff up, of course not, but rather that it accepts that our minds are primed by numerous sociocultural triggers, automatically interpret what we see within the prism of what we know. Just like the Aztecs of old, for example, who could only describe conquistador Cortes' ships as floating mountains. Sometimes our best description of some weird thing we've seen only helps to muddy the waters even more. Now, I think for our North American cousins, a greater understanding of their parent cultures, as patronizing as that might sound, is essential to understand why they keep experiencing these mysterious phenomena so closely resemble the folklore their colonial ancestors 4,000 miles away. Now, there could, of course, be more to it than Asian folklore reimagined for the modern world. But as I write in my book, Beast of the World's Hairy Humanoids, the law of parsimony, or Occam's razor, always dictates that the simplest explanation is usually the right one.
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, I've had to apply this to my own research here in the UK as well, where I was very behind this British Bigfoot research. At least I took up that mantle. There were others here before me. I joined the bandwagon a little bit later. Took a lot of flak, really, for saying there is a possibility for talking to the witnesses and other researchers. And as a hopeful believer in the existence of Bigfoot, I'd always assumed initially that it was a creature of faraway places like the mountain steppes of the Himalayas or the impenetrable forests of the Pacific Northwest, or some uninhabited no man's land where large ape-like creatures could plausibly remain undetected. However, when I began researching this phenomenon, I was shocked to discover that there were also numerous reports from Britain dating back hundreds of years, that they'd even had modern day reports of Bigfoot-like creatures spread across the country, from bottom of England to the top of Scotland, and so on and so forth, and that many of the accounts describe a tall, bipedal, muscular, and hair-covered wild man with a domed head and a face something resembling like that of a caveman or chimpanzee with a flat muzzle and a human-like nose. Of course, my first instinct was to seek out witnesses and see if there was any historical evidence to back up the modern day sightings. And what I found was a creature from our past called the Woodwose. This mythical creature, its popularity seemed to become most prominent in Europe from the 12th century onwards, where it's depicted as a wild, hair-covered man upon the architectural adornments of cathedrals and tapestries and in the heraldic coats of arms of prominent European families. So I thought, okay, so far so good. It's not often that one finds such corroboration in history, especially one so closely related to other mythical entities in Europe, like the satyr and faun and ogre and leshy, which are similarly described as shy, forest-dwelling, hair-covered beings, but not beyond carrying off the occasional maiden from time to time, right? Could this be the key, I'm thinking, to the unraveling of the wild man mystery? Now, is this where its origins come from? Sadly, no. After 6 years of searching the length and breadth of the country for this creature, I found scant evidence still exists in our land. Now, undoubtedly, there's more than a few eyewitness reports, but they're notoriously lacking in attribution and provenance, often being second or even third-hand reports. They too often emanate from sources of skin in the game, so to speak, or at least something to gain from the proliferation of the legend. My sad conclusion is that even though there's 12th century carvings that feature so prominently upon the holy houses of Europe and are themselves a form of inherited folklore, a memorial, if you like, in cloth and stone to the stories of a bygone era, and although they may have once existed in Europe, these creatures, they probably were extinct already by the time these carvings and tapestries came into being in the 11th and 12th centuries. That doesn't mean that Britain doesn't have any cryptic creatures in its midst, though. And happily,
My faith in one of these cryptids in particular was recently revived when I had the privilege of documenting the biggest search for Nessie in 50 years for a new TV series that I'm involved in called Weird Britain. So I'm the presenter of that series. Comes out in April, I think, first on Blaze, later on Sky and History, in the UK at least, and hopefully a little later in the year in the US and Europe. Whilst on this documentary, whilst making this documentary, we headed up to this biggest expedition in 50 years with Alan McKenna from the Loch Ness Exploration team, and we brought thermal drones, ROVs, hydrophones, sonar, night vision technology, and worked really closely with the guys there from Loch Ness Exploration and others, a whole host of great experts. The document is crowdsourced observation of the waters of Loch Ness, and finally, hopefully, to find some proof of the elusive beast. And what can I say? Although definitive evidence wasn't obtained, there were many triumphs, throughout the expedition weekend, such as the hydrophone bloops, which were obtained aboard the vessel Deep Scan while we filmed Alan and our expert guest King Gerhard listening to the sounds of the loch, and interviewing Maggie and Agger, two wild swimmers who'd come to lend their aquatic expertise to the hunt and filmed a three-humped object near Fort Augustus whilst doing so. We also interviewed a Japanese-born translator, Chi Kelly, who snapped what Steve Feltham described as the most exciting photos of the Loch Ness Monster from the shores of Doris Beach in 2018. She didn't share these pictures for 5 years and for fear of being ridiculed until the expedition took place, and she felt overwhelmed by the spirit of this extensive search, this big Nessie loving, that hadn't happened for half a century. Realized she couldn't keep them a secret any longer, which I think is, it's really amazing. And as mentioned, Nessie Hunter, Guinness Book of World Records holder Steve Feltham said that they were most exciting photographs that he'd ever seen taken of the Loch Ness Monster, which is, it's definitely something. And we do have to remember is that the Loch Ness Monster, unlike the British Bigfoot, has 90 years of continuous sightings, and even has older sightings dating back all the way to 565 AD, with corroborative reports being made by eyewitnesses from every walk of life, from hundreds of countries around the world. Whereas the British Bigfoot, that's a feature of the High Middle Ages, disappeared from our histories till the advent of Yeti Mania in the early 20th century, and again later when Bigfoot Mania reappeared on the media scene with the hugely successful Finding Bigfoot. So one has to ask oneself, was there ever in modern times really a British Bigfoot? And if not, why did this legend gain such prominence again? Why do people believe that they have seen it? Well, there are many, many tales of British Bigfoots, if you like, and some of them have occurred in the modern era. But again, provenance is the issue, and some of the more archaic sightings in the modern era do possibly relate back to this talk of the Yeti in the Himalayas. One of these would be the Big Grey Man of Benguet-Dewi. Benguet-Dewi being a big mountain in the Cairngorm Mountains. The summit of Benguet-Dewi is home to the Big Grey Man, Fearlamore. And this is a kind of folkloric throwback to when this misty land, now colloquially known as Great Britain, was populated by cruel giants who ruled a land that was then known as Albion, or to the Irish neighbours in the east, the land of the mighty. Benguet-Dewi is the biggest mountain in the Cairngorms and the second highest in the UK. It's a very sterile environment, not conducive to supporting a large omnivore, and also harsh, barren slopes. Nothing really grows, save a few resilient alpine plants. In the winter, the northern sun barely penetrates the thick cloud cover and the mist, and this rolls in unexpectedly, time and time and again. It can cover the land for days, in fact, creating this eerie landscape shrouded in mists and a mystery.
for which the uninitiated can begin to feel assailed, like they're being secretly watched by mysterious beings that can emerge from the mist at any time. And strange sounds like cracks and whines, and even the sound of heavy footfall, often heard by lonely climbers trapped in the mountain's environment, and blind to what's happening on the outside by the dense fog. Now, what are these? Are the environmental and meteorological groans this area, steeped in shadowy antiquity? No one knows. Yet some believe that the mountain hides a hairy hominid, giant proportions, and this is the Feel of More, the big green man in Scots Gaelic, Bemwintwee. Supposed to stand 10 to 20 feet tall, he's covered with thick grey, olive, or brown short hair, pointed ears, and broad shoulders. So long arms, long legs, and long finger-like talons on its hands and feet. So in many ways, not matching a lot of Bigfoot-like descriptions. It has allegedly left some evidence over time. So on December 22nd, 1952, James Allen Rennie photographed a series of tracks in the snow that was 19 inches long, 14 inches wide, with a stride of 7 feet. Tracks were traveling in a perfectly straight line on the mountain, and at one point they even appeared to have entirely jumped a distance of 30 feet over a road that must have been perceived as an obstacle impeding the creature's onward journey. It's said to be more aggressive than its Asian and American counterparts as well, often appearing in thick fog or mist and frightening the lonely travelers who get stuck on the mountain, making odd crunching noises that sound like heavy footsteps and a high-pitched droning hum, or this echoing eerie sine wave that crosses the mountain. People say its presence is preceded by an icy feeling in the air that induces distress and dread, or depression and apathy. And it's a strong belief among climbers, or there used to be, that it's got the power to affect your emotional state with strong and irrational impulses. Some witnesses even claiming that they felt irresistibly compelled to hurl themselves off the mountain. And its presence could also, sometimes in more ancient tales, at least, be accompanied by ghostly music and voices and laughter, which shows the ghoulish beginnings of this legend before the Bigfoot legend took hold. One of the earliest modern witnesses of the Big Green Man was somebody called Norman Collie. He was a professor of chemistry, actually, at the University College in London. He was also a passionate hill walker. And during the annual general meeting of the Cairngorm Club in Aberdeen, the dark winter's night, December 1925, he told a story to the members there of a most strange experience he'd had on the mountain in 1891. Now, he's an experienced climber. He'd been returning from the summit when he heard the crunch of footsteps behind him. To every step he took, he heard another crunch nearby, as if someone was following him, with a stride 3 or 4 times the size of his own. Collie said to the group, "Every few steps I took, I heard a crunch. It was as if someone was walking after me, but taking steps 3 to 4 lengths of mine." He maintained that although he never saw anyone, he was certain something was there. Terrified at the prospect of meeting a giant stalker, he ran downhill for the last few miles. Well, again, this is an experience with an unknown animate, an unknown entity on the mountainside there. He didn't see a Bigfoot. He didn't even see a person. It could have been a normal person whose footsteps were amplified by the rocky terrain. So that's a 50-50. Could have been Bigfoot, could have been something else. But in 1904, Hugh Welsh and his brother, studying plants and arachnids near the summit of Bemwintwee, were conscious of soft sounding footsteps around them whenever they were moving. Curiously, they pointed out the footsteps didn't match their own footfalls, which would be expected if they were the results of echoes from the mountainside. They noticed that the curious sounds were more distinct during daylight hours, and it was basically following them over a period of days. Again, could this be stalkers more than unknown creatures up in the mountains? Still nothing solid there. In the 1920s, Tom Crowley, experienced climber, former president of the Moray Mountaineering Club, also heard footsteps as he was descending Brerach, a peak to the west of Ben Dwy, across the Larraig Gurw Pass into Glenelg. He paused and turned his head to glance over his shoulder and saw a tall grey figure. So this is the first time somebody sees something, and he described it as having pointed ears, long legs and finger-like talons on its feet, approaching him from behind. So the legend is taught to take shape. Here is a creature, an animal, suddenly, or at least a large man with very, very unusual dimensions. Still in the 1920s, somebody called Alexander Mitchell Kellas, an experienced climber and scientist, together with his brother Henry, is ascending the mountain summit and sees a 10-foot-tall giant figure moving towards them in the direction of the Larraig Gurw Pass. They watched the shape walk to the summit, circle the cairn, and then disappear back into the pass. Again, the same decade, other climbers are starting to see a figure. Who knows if word had gotten out at this point? In 1940, Richard Frere details an encounter related to him by a friend, been camping at the top of the mountain in 1940. Now, he'd settled down to sleep in his tent for the evening, and he woke suddenly and noticed movement outside the tent's opening, and as he peered out of the tent, he observed this large, broad-shouldered, brownish humanoid creature. It's been 20 feet in height, already we've gained 10 more feet now, moving around his camp, emitting an air of insolent strength before eventually moving off. And he claimed he'd also experienced these strange fears and senses of dread before and after, obviously after this experience. 1942, legendary climber, this time William Sidney Scroggie, camping out at the shelter stone by the Garvish on Ben Dwy, when he saw a tall, imperial figure taking large, deliberate steps towards the burns flowing onto Loch Arvan. We don't really know. There's no description there. Was it hairy? Was it Bigfoot-like? Was it a giant person? Again, these myths, these legends seem to be getting mixed together, but they are taking shape. 1943, naturalist and mountaineer Alexander Tunian had a harrowing confrontation with the great man. And this account appeared in the Scots magazine in June 1958, some years later. And he said, "I am not unduly imaginative, but my thought flew instantly to the well-known story of Professor Colley and the Feel of Moor." So he already knew about the ancient tales. Let's make a note of that. "Then I felt the reassuring weight of the loaded revolver in my pocket. Grasping the butt, I peered about in the mist, here rent and tattered by the eddies of wind. Strange shape loomed up, receded, came charging at me. Without hesitation, I whipped out the revolver and fired three times at the figure. When it still came on, I turned and hared down the path, reaching Glenderry at a time that I have never bettered. You may ask, was it really the Feel of Moor? Frankly, I think it was. Many times since then, I have traversed McDewey in the mist, bivouacked out in the open, and camped on its summit for days on end on different occasions, often alone, and always with an easy mind. But on that day, I am convinced I shot the only Feel of Moor my imagination will ever see." So still, it's not really clear whether he thinks it was real. He was aware of Professor Colley's experience there, so it was already in his mind. And, who knows if he had seen a person or something unusual. Now, there's a caveat to this. There is something that takes place in these mountainous environments, and especially in Ben Dwy, called a Brocken Spectre effect. Could sightings of the Big Grey Man be nothing more than a meteorological hallucination? According to some skeptics, this common atmospheric anomaly, the Brocken Spectre effect, is responsible for all eyewitness accounts and not a flesh and blood monster. So it's more like this rare alien atmospheric anomaly is produced when the sun hits the mist and magnifies a person's elongated shadow on clouds, a mist or fog. And this gives the illusion of a giant humanoid form looming out of the mist towards a justifiably terrified witness, who's blissfully unaware of the literal trick of the light that's being played upon him. And this effect, which also is accompanied by a glory, like a rainbow-like halo, could add to the otherworldly experience which the eyewitness believes he's or she's got undergoing. I think there's also things like high altitude hallucinations that could be brought about by oxygen starvation. Could this the people seeing the legendary Big Green Man be suffering from these hallucinations or disseminated imagery and legendary that's inherited in the Highland legends, mixed with a concoction of all manner of sounds and shapes and worries that seem to gather upon an individual when they're in an isolated area all alone. So, yeah, this reminds me really that it's a very, very intense subject. It's a very big subject. It's a huge ask to get people to believe in such a thing. And there are those who could be forgiven for thinking that our current international obsession with Bigfoot started on May 29th, 2011, the airing of the first Finding Bigfoot episode in the Travel Channel. That this delicious foray that we're into Bigfoot in, sometimes awkwardly translated into television, but in my view, possibly one of the most universally appealing and groundbreaking shows about cryptozoology ever to grace the silver screen, was the start of all of this, with this wonderfully simplistic methods of calling in the squatch, tree knocks and howls, and these tedious treks through the woods, preferably after dark, adorned with these modified Ghostbusters get-ups, inclusive of night vision selfie cams for the unflattering under-chin close-ups to the cast, to what was then, a virgin audience, ever hungry, the hairy men, and getting some accessibility to these expeditions out into the woods, which this show created, which it gave to people at that point, and it has since gone on to become, I suppose, a defining method of making television. However, notwithstanding that, to the long-serving and long-suffering Sasquatch enthusiasts around the world, the origination point, or at least the public nativity, this phenomenon can be traced back to two men, and that's Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin, who claimed to film a strange encounter with a large bipedal female hairy hominid in Bluff Creek, California, 1967. And although this famous film, infamous film now, really, with its hairy star, who's since become affectionately known as Patty, came some time even after Ivan T. Sanderson's 1962 book, Abominable Snowmen, Legend Come to Life, and certainly long after Shipton's famous photograph of alleged tracks of a Yeti, captured during his 1951 Everest expedition, the fact remains, the PG film was and remains the celluloid inauguration on which the Bigfoot legend began to get international acclaim, especially in the United States. It's now almost solely associated with the United States. Even the name Bigfoot, which was coined by newspaper columnist Andrew Ganzoli in the Humboldt Times after a series of large man-like tracks were found near Bluff Creek in 1958. And like many of our mysterious and elusive candidates for cryptozoology, the name became a catch-all identifier for a numerous number of other hairy humanoids that might not be as closely related to Bigfoot as their hairy upright form suggests, but do exist around the world. It was inaugurated, was celebrated worldwide. I mean, it's definitely universally recognized nickname Sasquatch, and myriad other names in North America and Europe, where we find accounts going back hundreds of years among the First Nations population, accounts of things like cannibal giants, Buckwheats, Zuniqua, and Omar, They're all ingrained. Their traditions, art, and archaeology. In fact, even in their, as we mentioned earlier, their European counterparts of various forms of wild men, going back for eons, hundreds, thousands of years, even back to the Greeks, perhaps. Who knows? This creature, however, Bigfoot, the North American Bigfoot or man ape, this is a very physically imposing species compared to many of the European wild man stories. This is standing somewhere between 7 to 9 feet tall, weighing between 650 to 1,000 pounds. It's got a pointed head with a sloping forehead and a heavy brow ridge, a flat face with wide mouth, these deep set eyes and flat nose, and his body is bulky and huge with wide shoulders and long arms that hang below the waist. Fur covered always, was it black, light brown, gray, white, even sometimes. It's hard to equate it with anything other than the American standard of, bigger, better, shinier, bulkier, faster. And I often wonder if there's something in that. Even the Himalayan Yeti doesn't seem to reach these proportions. And yet, there does seem to be something in some of the tales. Once again, there are similar worldwide. Bigfoot primarily nocturnal, even though many sightings do occur during the day. Primarily solitary animals, although family groups are occasionally seen, and they are inquisitive animals, often attracted to human activity, and will sometimes, for better or worse, even interact with people. Although often these interactions seem to be territorial or in nature, and constitute an ushering out the human intruder from their locale to various levels of harassment, such as rock, sticks throwing, howls and growls, and whistles and wood knocks and whoops, and that awful, strong, overwhelming stench, like a skunk-like deterrent that people describe all the time. And very, very rarely, face-to-face intimidation, for the most part, despite their superior size and strength, they tend to keep their distance from humans and will opt to move away if seen or approached. And this all still really, really seems like folklore. And again, as mentioned at the beginning of this discussion, people in North America would do well to acknowledge and remember the ancestral tales that they have inherited their European counterparts, and how this might influence their interpretation of what they see. But there's a caveat to that, which is there is some kind of evidence of Bigfoot in North America. There are tracks. There are tracks 14 to 18 inches in length, with all of the toes being of a similar size and shape, sitting in a straight line, flat-footed, broader and flatter foot, wider than a human's, that appears to display an unusual midfoot flexibility, commonly known among Bigfoot researchers as the mid-tarsal pressure ridge, which could be a physiological feature observed primarily in tracks, which shows an indentation seen towards the heel imprint, and which is believed to be the result of force being transferred to the ground when the mid-tarsus flexes as the heel lifts. That causes the weight to be focused under the forefoot, which would be a very helpful adaptation in supporting a large bipedal hominoid in precipitous and rough topography, which is common in the areas in which this animal is seen in North America. Again, they have been observed, allegedly by witnesses, eating a variety of foods, which would make them omnivorous, similar to bears, eating roots, berries, grasses, corn, apples, clams, fish larvae, rodents, deer, other similar fare, anything really that they can seem to get their hands on. And even though Native American folklore does
tell of tales of cannibal giants kidnapping women folk and predating other people. Similarly to European legends, they don't seem to be supported, these tales, by modern day Bigfoot encounters in North America. As to the habitat, traditionally it seems to be the montane forests, western North America, Northern California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Alaska, in the USA at least, and places like British Columbia, Alberta in Canada. However, there are more and more Bigfoot-like reports throughout North America. Clearly, they're outside the traditional known distribution zone. And yeah, it shouldn't surprise people really to discover that the reports outside of this traditional zone of Bigfoot inhabitation, these mountain forests, have risen exponentially with the advent of popular Bigfoot television shows, conferences, and you know, the mercantile machinations of very clever salesmen. So, you know, who knows? You know, there are several Bigfoot-like sightings, like the skunk ape, for example, that might be representative of a distinct relic ape species, being coined napes by some, which are reported in North America and other diverse locales around the world. But we don't really know if there is even a divergence in this unknown hairy humanoid-like animal. Well, for hair and other forms of evidence, there is evidence, but there's also nothing conclusive ever really seems to have been identified. I'm not an expert on that type of evidence at all. You know, many hair samples defy identification. Some species have been attributed to various hairy humanoids over the years. And I think that's because hair is seen as easy evidence to obtain. It's got a natural resistance to decay, and it's not appealing to scavengers, and so it lasts. But you know, many researchers that they put off collecting hair samples because of the perceived costs of lab analysis and the expertise needed sometimes, I suppose, to determine what is a natural known animal hair out there in the world, and what is Bigfoot? You know, one would have to assume that most of the time, what you're looking at is natural animal hair, buffalo, cows, the horses, foxes, badgers, whatever. They're going to be leaving their hair all around the place most of the time. And this very elusive, very unusual, and rare animal, one would assume that you are not finding its hair in any of the situations in which you are obtaining hair samples. So you do really need to be sure. I remember Professor Jeff Meldrum writing somewhere, you know, researchers should look for hairs that have parallel sided shafts with blunt worn tips that are several inches long. That one could use a jeweler's optivisor to examine any prospective samples. But I must admit, even if I had a jeweler's optivisor and I was looking at a hair sample, I'd be very hard pushed indeed to be able to identify hairs with parallel sided shafts, but with blunt worn tips. It just wouldn't really know what I was looking at. And that's why I think if you do collect hair and send it off for analysis, there needs to be more to that sighting than you've just come across some hair. Maybe hair next to a big footprint, or hair just after you've sighted a Bigfoot, or somebody has seen one in that very area several days before. That's the kind of hair that you could be investigating. And scat too, I don't know. There's so many the ways to, and there's so many online guides to identify known animal scat. I think if you're looking for the Bigfoot scat, you really again need to be in an area where you know there has been a recent sighting, or where you've had a sighting yourself, and there's other corroborating forms of evidence around. But let's go to more tangible forms of evidence, like film photography. There have been many Bigfoot photos over the years. There was course, the very famous Todd Standing Bigfoot films, which impressed many, many people and caused many, many others to think that this was the most brazen hoaxer in Bigfoot history. But there is older, disputable evidence, which is, and some of the most famous evidence being that captured on October 20th, 1967, and which would ultimately change the course of hairy humanoid research forever. That was the footage captured by Roger Patterson and Bob Gilman, showing a large, hair-covered bipedal hominoid, pendulous breasts, walking away from them rather hurriedly in Bluff Creek, California. And still, this film, is held up as one of the most incontrovertible pieces of evidence in existence, and often lauded within the community as indisputable proof of the existence of a large undiscovered hominoid in North America, and as the benchmark of all Bigfoot evidence. Now, I would say, it's noteworthy that film evidence in our current era is of easily accessible, off-the-shelf CGI, doesn't automatically constitute hard evidence anymore. And anybody wishing to present their own celluloid encounter with a hairy humanoid to the general public should expect their findings to be dissected in a very undignified manner. But even looking back to this, there were many claimants over the years. People had claimed to have been involved in faking it. Special effects, and costume designers and special effects people were said to be involved and even to have claimed to be involved over the years. And yet, you hear shouts of people who worked on Planet of the Apes, confessions from the maker of American Werewolf in London as to who might have made these this suit that is worn on that day. And what I can say from seeing that footage is that you can clearly see muscles moving under the fur. You can clearly see the physicality of the creature or person, whatever you want to call it, walking across there. It does seem to be a very odd addition to add breast to a suit that nobody would expect it to be there. So these are all things in favor of the creature. Apparently the gait is impossible to replicate as well, which I don't personally believe. I think some of those studies about the gait might have been done with by people with something to gain, proving that it could have been manufactured. But there is something about the behavior of the creature and something about the behavior of the men. It is clear that Patterson has fallen off his horse and is stumbling around with the camera. It's all over the place. That really lines up. It really lines up that he is certainly acting as though shocked when he takes that footage. Because if he'd set that up, really the best thing to do then would to be to get the best, the clearest footage anybody has ever gotten of this creature walking away, since the suit seems to be so wonderfully well made as well. And yet he doesn't. He falls, he stumbles. The horse rears. Maybe it was the horse's fault and not his. Maybe he didn't expect the horse to rear and chuck him off when he was filming. Maybe that wasn't part of the plan. But it definitely does add to the feeling that this is a natural situation and not a setup. Everything that has happened since that time, who even knows? Who knows? Because the film was taken in a very mercantile country in which people, genuine or not, always find a way to profit from their research. And so, there's been so many despoilers and takers and claimants to be fakers, to be genuine provers of this footage over the years, simply because there is money in it. And that money's the worth so much. Nobody will probably ever know. I don't know. But it looks pretty genuine to me. Let's move on to sticks and stones, things like nesting homes. for the Bigfoot. These things are reported all over the world. So there's scores of hairy humanoid groups online that consist of nothing more than photographs of sticks and stones. Literally, just sticks and stones and little teepees. And this, it's become something of a feeder pill within the peripheral community, which perpetuates an unhealthy cycle of confirmation bias. Whereas stick signs and nests and rock stacking could certainly be a sign of activity, one should be cautious of attributing activity or habituation to these signs that other indicators being present. So in an old documentary called Sticks and Stones, UK Bigfoot, that I did with British Bigfoot filmmaker Christopher Turner, we went out to this big forest in Scotland and we examined the perils and the pitfalls of attributing such signs to Bigfoot and logically hypothesized that Bigfoot-like creatures were the cause of a tree break or rock formation. Several other confirmatory signs should be observable within the same area. And these were things like tracks and footprints, basically an animal capable of placing two large tree limbs into an X formation as a rudimentary territorial marker, have to leave some evidence of its exertions. So one would expect to find tracks in and around these large structures. And there's things like hair, which we've already discussed. Animals that habituate in an area often leave evidence of themselves behind, like hair. So a creature dragging and lifting large tree limbs would expect to snag a few hairs at least along the way. And so a close examination of the structures that people are claiming to be Bigfoot made, that's mandatory. And the last thing, of course, is the scat bones. Such large, energetic animals, they require a high calorie intake. And if habituated an area long enough, place various markers and structures about the place, they need to stop and eat, and after some time, defecate. There you go. Logically speaking, scat and animal remains should be present within the vicinity of said stick structures. So, that's just one of the things that you've got to look out for. It's all very well for us to come out and say, I've seen one, you haven't seen one, you don't get to comment. But this is believer psychology. Do you believe in the Holy Virgin? Do you believe in this God? Do you believe in that God? Do you believe in do you believe in UFOs? No, I don't. I have a problem with your evidence. Oh, well, you haven't seen one like I have. Therefore, you don't get to comment. Everything you say is BS because of it. But for those of us who've not partaken in that experience, only seeing can be believing. And once believing, that's only relevant to the individual, not to the community at large. The community at large needs evidence, needs proof. If we're not talking about, supernatural phenomena, that evidence and proof should be available in some form or another. And this becomes like a belief. The initiated and the non-initiated, the believers and the non-believers. This is bad for science and scientific inquiry. If we were to have proposed before the discovery of the Okapi, okay, this was a creature that had been spoken about by locals, but had not been discovered by modern science. If we had said, well, the Okapi has the Okapi. Me has supernatural abilities. It's able to disappear into portals in the forest because we can't find it. It can control your mind. It can manifest and demanifest at will. And it comes from an astral plane or a UFO or something like this. What we've said about it, and then people said, "Well, where's the proof of the Okapi? Can you show me?" Hoof prints, can you show me scattered the Okapi? Can you show me film or a body for the Okapi? And we said to them, you don't know what you're talking about. You haven't seen one. So you don't have the right to speak. That does not help scientific inquiry. That doesn't help us to catalogue this animal, to place it to the annals of natural fauna and flora. Of the world. And indeed, the descriptions of your Kepi could have been very off-putting. Well, it's kind of like a short-necked giraffe with brown skin and a zebra's legs and two horns on top of its head. You would say, come on, this is ridiculous. What kind of animal looks like a brown giraffe with a short neck and a zebra's legs? That's just a crazy chimeric, crazy chimeric monster that you've come up with there. You've just spliced a couple of creatures together to try to frighten off the local kids. But no, we know now. We discovered it. It actually exists. It looks hilarious. It's a strange, beautiful, but strange looking animal. This shows the vulnerability of our descriptive powers when faced with an animal for which our mental library has no descriptive experience, which has no descriptive experience. It's hard to translate to people what they're seeing. And again, referencing the Aztecs when they saw Cortes, the conquistadors' ships sailing towards them, the best they could do was describe them as floating mountains. Ships don't look like mountains. We know they don't look like mountains, but they'd never seen ships. That's what they had in their mind. It's the best explanation they could come up with. We have to be aware of that too. We have to stick with scientific inquiry. That which cannot be proved remains unproven. It remains open for interpretation until such time the evidence sits clearly upon the desk of the scientists and is verified, peer reviewed, and all of the rest of it. I don't believe that science doesn't want to discover Sasquatch or Nessie or whatever else might be out there. I'm sure they would be happy and they would love to find such a thing and accept it as a real bona fide animal, if the proof was available. And that's what we have to remember. We're not fighting against some mad conspiracy. We are fighting against a folkloric, inherited, mental imagery, and those tales that have impacted upon us and our communities for hundreds, thousands of years almost, and how we are interpreting some of these unknown creatures, which could possibly exist and be out there in very few numbers, still hanging on to survival.